Patient Dave. Woo. Woohoo! And he is an amazing man.
He is E.
He is E. And when I first met Dave, I met him via phone, okay? And Twitter, and this is his jacket. This is our first meeting, is when we got to talk to each other when my husband was sick with cancer. And he was this amazing mentor in this space. He had the same kind of cancer that my husband had. My husband died. Dave got to live, in part because of amazing communication with his doctor and access to the kind of medication he needed, and being able to find the disease at the period he was able to find. But he's spectacular, and since that happened, his arc of growth has been astronomical, okay? And he is helping change the world and make it better for us all. So a big round of applause for E. Patient Dave.
So I have a plan for a talk that I've never given before. It's a completely new assemblage of things that a lot of them I have discussed, but never in this context. But it's also highly likely that things will go whatever direction we feel like them going, because that's the kind of group this is. And so I'm going to cover something. I'm going to review my story, my cancer story, a bit for those who don't know it. But I'm also going to talk about, it was in 2009 that I wrote a blog post about garbage in my medical record. And much to my amazement, 3 days later, the Boston Globe called and said, "We think this is important." And I was like, "What?" And they not only wrote about it, because what I didn't realize was the federal stimulus bill had just been passed, and everybody was saying, how are we going to get data into these electronic medical record systems? And so that's why it was a big deal in Washington. And they didn't just write about it. They put it on page one, and my life started spinning out of control. And that was a week before the Health 2.0 conference in Boston. People have said if this were a Disney movie, everyone would say this only happens in Disney movies. Because it's like, there's the blogger at home in Nashua, New Hampshire. And then the front page of the newspaper comes spinning out of the screen. And then there's the Health 2.0 conference. And Dave is wandering around and people are saying, I can't believe you're that guy. I can't believe I get to meet you. I'm like, what? And somebody called my name from the stage. I was up in the balcony. And I said, I'm up here. And Teddy Tan, the wonderful Kaiser doc, later said on his blog it was the first time he ever saw healthcare look up to a patient. And somebody took out her iPhone and tweeted, Pope Dave preaches from the balcony. And a month later, I'm not kidding, you can look it up. And a month later, I was in Washington. And when I first testified on meaningful use, the big movie-style, horseshoe-shaped table of microphones and august people, I said, I feel a little bit like Reese Witherspoon in Legally Blonde. You know, I don't have a chihuahua in my pocket, but I'm not sure how I got here. Well, a lot has happened in the 6 years since then. There has been what I would call an increasing listening for the patient's perspective in medicine. And as you'll see, this is not a new idea, but it's taking forever for medicine, and including policy people and the people in positions of quiet, perhaps secret power, to get it into their skulls. And the question for us as change advocates is, what can we say that will make any difference? This is a real problem, because piling on more facts does not change people whose head is stuck in an old view of the world. And when you think about it, it really is a waste of breath, no matter how passionate you are about something, to say something that won't make any difference. All right? And some of this takes generations, in some cases, to change how people are thinking. You're welcome. Two things I want to mention Two things. How many times in your life have you said that, Casey? I'm with you, sister.
The time available, yeah.
All right. I want to mention that 2 years ago, the world started talking more about patient engagement. The big policy journal, Health Affairs, had a whole issue dedicated to it, which to me is like listening to patients. instead of telling us to shut up and do as we're told, otherwise known as compliance. I saw that a lot of things in there were just not the right approach as far as I was concerned. So I took all my talking points from my speeches, because by that, well, now I'm up to something like 450 speeches and policy meetings in 13 countries trying to spread the word. Anyway, a couple of years ago, I wrote Let Patients Help, which is the slogan at the end of my TED talk. And it's a simple book. It's nowhere near the quantity and quality of Regina's writing. It's a distillation of my talking points, so it's sort of a handy reference, and I asked my doctor to contribute part of it, and I've got copies to give away in the back. And so Sonny said, but I want to buy it. So I decided anybody who wants to pitch in some money, it'll go to Cinder Blocks, but they're here for you to take. So. Oh, I moved them up here so I wouldn't forget to mention them.
Okay.
I don't care.
The library committee.
I have a way of eating up half my speaking time with my prologue. This is an essential thing. As I'm sure everyone here knows, there is a big policy war going on right now in Washington having to do whether the federal government is pretty much going to require, and this is, by the way, I was a marketing guy before I got sick, so I like slogans, and if they rhyme, that's even better. People perform better if they're informed better. The issue of whether we have access to our information is core, and yet I have new thoughts that are in this talk today that I had not had yet a week ago. Things are advancing very rapidly, and it's like turbulence. You know, if you've ever been in a boat when the waves start doing this, choppy in both directions, I don't know how things are going to turn out. I do know that we have every right, and nobody's going to do it for us, to speak from the patient's perspective. And when I say patient, I mean those of us who are taking care of family members and so on, people on the receiving end of service, previously known as consumers, except that we actually are creating value ourselves now in healthcare as well. This is an important thing. Information alone doesn't change behavior, and I'm going to quickly flow and this is so important because I have talked to people who seem to think that it's sort of like, Josh, you can tell me if I'm wrong on this. In some ways, a large part of law involves you come in with a bigger stack of irrefutable facts than somebody else, and you're supposed to win. Well, in social change, which this is, that is not enough. And I'll give you a series of slides here for one thing the Kaiser Family Foundation has been tracking. This graph, this is the 2010 version of this graph. And what it is down here is inflation and workers' wages, right? And up here is the cost of health care and employee premiums for this health insurance. Now that's 2010. You'd think people would say, holy crap, that's terrible. Well, here's the 2011 version of it. Not much change. Here's the 2012 version of it. Here's the 2013 version of it, and the 2014 version of it. All right, so now, compared to 1999, when they started doing this, wages are up 54%, and how much we put in is up 212%. And on top of that, get this, how's this for an article in Health Affairs? The pricing of U.S. hospital services, chaos behind a veil of secrecy.
Yeah.
And that was published. Anybody know when that was published?
2006.
So that was 10 years ago, and we only now, last week, had an announcement that Medicare, you know, the government healthcare organization that pays all the money, they're finally going to release the data on who's getting how much of what. Let's see. All right, I want to briefly cover the history of the e-patient movement. For those who don't know, Tom Ferguson is sort of the founder of this movement. He came out of Yale Medical School in the post-Woodstock era years, 1978. And he was all about power to the people. There was a hippie self-sufficiency magazine at the time called the Whole Earth Catalog, How to Grow Your Own Food, Build Your Own House. He was the medical editor of it in the 1980s. And he knew that although we can do a lot of stuff for ourselves, when trouble hits, like stage 4 kidney cancer, like Regina's husband and I had, a big thing that limits how much we can contribute is access to information. And when the web came along, so this is one aspect of information, an important dimension that meaning the policy wars are about now is access to our chart. But another is access to information about treatment options and everything we can do to help. He saw that when the internet came along, that would turn that on its head, and he predicted things that would start happening. And you can study his history more on the ePatients.net blog. He was a visionary. In less than a year after the first web browser, he published a triangle of how healthcare was structured and how it was going to be structured in the future. And what he predicted 20 years ago is just coming true today. That's a kind of visionary. I like to follow that sort of person. Anyway, he started spotting people who were doing the things he predicted. On the far left there is Jill Friedman, who founded ACOR, the network of cancer patient communities that I joined. Next to him is Alan and Cheryl Green. He's a pediatrician who published the first physician website recognized by the AMA. There's my doctor, Danny Sands. Next to him is Susanna Fox, who is the brand newly appointed U.S. Chief Technology Officer. Woo-hoo. Well, it's more like game on now, okay? Because the forces of darkness are saying, not on my watch,
right?
The Empire strikes back, but we're strong.
Anyway, he coined this term e-patients. Originally, it meant patients who are online back in the 90s, because by definition, so today we say equipped, engaged, empowered, enabled. Educated about evidence, expert, people are making up all kinds of new meanings, that's fine. That means the idea lives out there, which is what we need. And see, today, everybody, including disempowered lunatics, are online. So you don't have to be equipped, engaged, empowered, enabled. So this is what I talk about. Well, in 2009, this gang of crazies decided the time had come to stop being just a hobby club and actually form a society, and they called it the Society for Participatory Medicine. Now, you can tell that they were still pretty much doctors and academics, because who would call what we're doing Society for Participatory Medicine? It's 14 syllables. You know, my slogan is, let patients help. And not only that, but you can chant that, right? At the end of my TED Talk, let patients help. Let patients, Society for Participatory. Anyway, they importantly, and at the time, I had no idea what was happening. This society wasn't my idea. None of what happened was my idea. And this was all before the Boston Globe article happened. So this is like if this were a Disney movie, it would be like the storm brewing. Anyway, they decided this society couldn't be run by just the doctor. So they decided it had to be a doctor and a patient, and they elected my doctor and me. So I was just, how weird is that? Important thing to go back and tell everybody in your lives, with computers in the exam room now, this triangle arrangement is important. All right? The computer between the two of you, so you can look at it together. There are many, many complaints, valid ones, from doctors, from nurses, from patients, and so on, that the clinician's attention now is always on the computer, right? If you do it together, that helps. Also, even my wonderful doctor makes typos, right? And after the record is signed off, they are legally not allowed to go back and fix it. They have to add a correction, which means that that depends on somebody who goes and looks at it later has to notice that there was a correction, because they're not even allowed to put in "see correction." So like one of my x-ray reports identified me as a 53-year-old woman. And not quite, I don't think. It took months to get that fixed. People say this happens all the time. So one of the aspects of what we're doing is social change. So it's really important when you're doing social change. Those of you who lived through the women's movement, as a man or as a woman, will remember that, you know, things start to sound differently out there, and there's a whole lot of the whale that you sort of have to drag along. Well, so imagine my amazement. Health Leaders magazine, which goes to hospital executives, got wind of this that summer, and they came and interviewed Ted Eaton and Danny Sands and me and a bunch of other people. And much to our amazement, they made a cover story out of this. And this is important, because when we founded that society, we had no founding grant of $50,000 to go hire a PR firm or something like that. If we had, we would have said, "Dude, most excellent, you got us a cover story, patient of the future." But this was the editors of Health Leaders. Now, they sent a photographer to my house, and I thought it was going to be the usual headshot that you put in the body of the thing. Honestly, I would have worn a different shirt if I'd known they were going to do this. So, yeah, obviously, no PR firm was managing this. But this is kind of the point, because notice what they were saying was the patient of the future is a middle-aged schlump with a pop belly looking stuff up on the internet in a bad shirt. Or to Greg, maybe it's a beautiful shirt. I know it's a kind of surfer world, but I don't. Anyway, then every December, and remember this was 6 years ago, and I point to this stuff. If you ever talk to people about this and try to make the case for the validity of this, it's really useful to say this is not something that just showed up last week. This was 6 years ago, all right? Because that lets them say, oh, it exists. It's not just, it's just something I hadn't heard of, which is different from it doesn't exist. So they do this, 20 people who make healthcare better. Number one on the list was Atul Gawande, who is this author who writes these incredibly excellent books and New Yorker essays, and he's phenomenal. He really is he's really changing what people think about healthcare. Number two is Dean Kamen. He's best known as the inventor of the Segway scooter, but in 1976, he also invented the first wearable insulin pump, a backpack for people with diabetes. And he was there this year because his company is making robotic limbs for amputees. And these have gotten better and better. They got a lot of publicity after the Boston Marathon bombings, like a smart knee that can tell when the ground is unstable and so on. So Atul Gawande and Dean Kamen, imagine my shock when number three on the list was me in that stupid shirt. Importantly, though, Dr. Sands was there. So what the editors of Health Leaders were saying is that this new doctor-patient relationship belonged, and we didn't pitch them on this, they did this without our knowledge, belonged on the same page with Atul Gawande and Dean Kamen. So, and this was the point where I was starting to get asked to, like, come say more about that. And in my career working in marketing, I learned how to give effective audience-oriented speeches. So this was just a new thing to talk about. And in my own speaking, when I have a speaking contract with somebody, I have what I call a home run call. The first doctor who ever offered me money to give a speech at a medical conference in Minnesota, no surprise, perhaps the most forward-thinking state in medicine, he said that what he will do is he'll ask the client in advance, so what do you want for this audience, for this event? Why did you hire me? What would make you say afterwards, man, you knocked it out of the park? That was great. And so that's what I've learned to do, and it's how I make a living now. Now, it was hard. As Regina and those of you who've tried to do this know, it took 3 years for me to reach break even and just get caught up on my taxes, you know, with bounce checks and late fees on things. But finally, after 3 years, I got there. Quick review of my cancer story. I went in for a routine physical. I had a stiff shoulder, no pain. And long story short, on January 3rd, 2007, 9 o'clock on the dot, if you've had a diagnosis or a disaster story, you know what I mean. You remember the moment. My Dr. Sands called and said, your shoulder's going to be fine, but you've got something in your lung. And that's a sobering thing. And long story short, I got a CAT scan. That's a golf ball-sized tumor in the other lung. Turned out to be one of five. And it raises the question. It was obviously metastasized from somewhere else because it was obviously cancer in the lungs, except lung cancer doesn't look like that. So it raised the question, where's this from? Which conveniently, if you abbreviate it, comes out WTF.
Yeah.
Which is exactly how I felt about things. Anyway, later on, so an ultrasound, and then this is an MRI. That's one of the two primary tumors in my right kidney. It was large, certainly not the biggest one that's ever been found. And this is a diagram of stage 4 kidney cancer showing where all my tumors were. This one and this one and this one are from the generic diagram. So, like, I'm the poster child. And then I had all these additional ones, including I had one growing out of my tongue muscle in my mouth. And by the time I was able, the doctors wouldn't give me an absolute number prediction. But by the time I found a website, see, some people don't want to know, and that is fine with me. Some people think that I'm saying everyone should be like Dave, heaven forbid. But that some people just say, I'm scared to death, take care of me. That's fine with me. But what I say is when we want to help, when we want to feel like we're not powerless, like we can do something, oh, that's good. I hit the button that says turn black, please. Good. There we go. Let's find a way to do it. Well, anyway, I hunted for information, and it said my median survival was 24 weeks. That means in that study, which as it happens was back in 1994, but in that study, half the people in my condition were dead in 5.5 months. Well, and so this is, you may be familiar because of Facebook with the a comic strip drawn by a PhD called XKCD, PhD Comics. His girlfriend, now his wife, got a cancer diagnosis, and this is how he illustrated it. Now, before the diagnosis, you know, around the time of the 2008 election, politics was taking up a lot of life. People being wrong on the internet is a fairly constant amount, right? Code not working even though it should is a constant problem. And romance replaced politics, but then cancer, boom. And this is a great visualization. Or any other disaster, you know? And then there's what lies ahead. Well, importantly, because my doctor, Danny Sands, remember that Tom Ferguson slide, he knew Jill Friedman on ACOR, and he knew they have a good kidney cancer patient community. He suggested that I go join this online patient community. And I love the looks on doctors' faces in audiences when I say, my doctor recommended the internet. what? In longer talks, I have another story about how I met my wife on the internet, you know? But before I found her, I went through some suboptimal search results. Here's the thing. People tend to be simplistic about this, all right? People think you find one bad piece of advice, you're going to immediately follow it and kill yourself. Well, I did not marry the first woman that I found on Match.com, you know? And so that's a whole other long story. This is important because what we're getting into now is what Tom Ferguson talked about access to information, okay? Within the first 2 hours of my posting my first message on ACOR, I got back. This is an uncommon disease. Find a hospital that does a lot of cases. Most hospitals, no surprise, will not tell you that. They tell you what they can do for you. There's no cure, they said, but the stuff called high-dose interleukin sometimes works. It usually doesn't work. And this was the patient community, so they had no stake in convincing me of anything. They were just telling me what they'd lived through. When it does work, about half the time it's permanent and complete. Here I am 8 years later. The side effects are severe. They sometimes kill people. That's why you need to find a specialist case hospital that does a lot of cases. Don't let them give you anything else first. And here are four doctors in your area who do it and their phone numbers. Now, in Regina's case, 2 years later, after the long disaster of mistreatment and neglect that they'd been through, finally, through a mutual friend in her toy store where she worked, she got connected to me, which is what the phone call that night is about. And she ended up getting connected to my oncologist, and sadly, what he had to say after looking at the information was sometimes it's too late. And there's no guarantee that if she'd gotten connected to information like this earlier that things would have turned out differently. In a few minutes, I'll get to this. We have this urge for certainty, especially where we're desperate. But anyway, an important thing is here we are 8 years later. To this day, none of this information still exists in the medical literature where doctors are trained to look. Right? There is a difference between the priorities, and this is key to where we sit now with the meaningful use wars. There is a difference between what doctors are trained to do and what we need. They're not necessarily contradictory. In accounting, if you've ever taken business courses, there's an idea, a concept called two sets of books. Now, sometimes that's done for crooked purposes, to hide something. But there's also, I learned in business school that there are legitimate reasons to do that, because if you're running your business and there's something that you know from practical experience you need to keep track of, right? It may be important for the nature of your business. Your needs may be different from what the IRS and the Securities Exchange Commission require. All right? And I'm starting to think that what doctors are required to do in the medical record may be different from what we need and what we think is important. And the punchline on this, the bottom line, is that it may be that the only solution for this, because they are not in our lifetime going to get out from under the federal regulations, maybe we need to take matters into our own hands, you know, and while they're doing what they do, we just say, give me a freaking copy of it and I'll go off and do what I need with it, right? Give me my damn data, right? My life, my health, my data. Well, long story short, for me, surgery and interleukin work. There's that same tumor 50 weeks later. Interleukin is an immune system treatment. It goes boom in the body. And they didn't even cut me open to get at the tumors. The only surgery I had was to remove the kidney, of course. And by the way, some people think, I know people in this room don't think this way, but some people think that patient engagement, patient empowerment is anti-doctor. Well, I tell you, you know, I didn't even know I was sick. So I couldn't have diagnosed myself. I certainly couldn't have. My surgeon removed this mess laparoscopically, you know, tiny slits. I mean, how the heck do you get a kidney out through a tiny slit like that? I figured they'd have to slice it up. He said, no, you do not slice up an organ full of tumors because pieces can get loose. He snipped everything out, watching on a flat screen display, you know, snip, 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 and put it in a baggie and pulled it out through a bikini scar. Unbelievable. And no robot, no stinking robots. Right. Well, so here's the thing. Looking for signs of culture change. In 2013, the BMJ, the British Medical Journal, one of the most respected journals in the world, invited me to, and apparently in the world of medicine, it's a big deal if they invite you to do something instead of you having the idea yourself. They invited me to write this essay about this, and this is about how this played out. And I wanted to be sure that this was not just me speaking from the patient perspective. I wanted other doctors who read this to say, oh, okay, this stuff is real. So I asked my oncologist, what would you say to other doctors who read this? And what he agreed to be quoted saying is, you were really sick. I don't know if you could have tolerated enough medicine if you hadn't been so well prepared. And what he was talking about specifically was that I got additional information about how to cope with the side effects from my patient community, information that is not in the literature. And he believes that that made a difference in my survival. So this is quotable now. This stuff is real. Do not tell me, don't Google. Did anybody here know what the Belgian government did last fall?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. They had a big ad agency create these professionally produced videos of somebody Googling, I have an itchy eye, I wonder what my problem might be. And 2 hours later, he has warts growing out of his face and he's saying, oh my God, I'm dying. And this video, they bought the Google keywords for all kinds of symptoms. So if you Google itchy eye, you get an ad that says don't Google it and shows you this video.
Dick move.
The Belgian government.
Belgian government.
So if you Google Belgian government, don't Google it. You'll find it. But, you know, the Empire Strikes Back, you know, we had Phyllis Schlafly arguing against the Equal Rights Amendment and all that. Anyway, so here's a question I use for scientists. How can it be that this relevant information can exist outside of traditional channels? And here's, this is the mechanism. So this is a nice generic stick figure diagram of people all being connected together, kumbaya, lovely, lovely. But after using this for a couple of years, I realized the way to talk to doctors about this is that in medicine, information is like a nutrient. It enables a healthier response. And these social media connections are like capillaries. This is the mechanism by which information today can reach places that would not have happened 20, 30 years ago. It's exactly what Tom Ferguson predicted, although he certainly never imagined Twitter. So, and all these slides, by the way, are on my website, and if you want to use any of them, just write to me. This is not like a copyrighted product that I sell to people. I'm an evangelist, you know? Jesus didn't say, now keep your yap shut about that, right?
No, he didn't.
As far as we know, anyway. I think he...
So
anyway, this is... I want to mention that this year, the BMJ had an issue with a major supplement in it on patient-centered care. British Medical Journal, yes, which I... Thank you, Casey. And they actually published this diagram. There is... one of Regina's paintings is in here. Our friend Hugo Campos has things in here. Amanda Green, the amazing LA lupus lady, has a piece in this. And Amanda's article and my article in here are in the 99th percentile of social media response for anything the BMJ has ever done. So we're getting some listening going on. Anyway, in the old days, all knowledge did exist. Back in Tom Ferguson's childhood, if you will, did exist here and traveled through a one-way arrow. In Health 2.0 these days, sometimes some of us bring useful information to the table, but not if they say, stay off the internet. I don't have time for that, okay? Now, I am the first to say, I know doctors are under ridiculous time pressure. Something to suggest to people, who says it has to be the MD with the time-limited visit who helps us with our Googling? There are new practices, a company, for instance, called Iora Health, where when you get a primary physician, you also get a health coach assigned to you, and you can contact a health coach with questions about things between the visits. And they're succeeding in 6 states, and so that's... If somebody says the doctor doesn't have time for that, you just say, who says it has to be the doctor, you know? And the world we're in now is we're all swimming in a common pond of information. And we now understand it's not that people are inherently smarter, but we have this network. And in fact, all of life is a network of networks. And in fact, it's what's called, in information theory, going from a closed system to an open network. So this is the future, whether anyone likes it or not. Now, the Institute of Medicine published an important report that I'm going to mention for several different reasons here. This is in 2012, 382-page book. All right. Now, the Institute of Medicine is the top of academic medicine in America, maybe in the world, and they specifically said patient-clinician partnerships are one of the four cornerstones of the future of medicine. So what you are working on, what we are working on, is the future, and everybody who is stuck in the old world suffers during the change, but stay the course. Here's what they said. They actually said engaged, empowered patients. Harvey Feinberg was the head of the IOM at the time. I emailed him. I said, couldn't you just say e-patients? You know, it'd make my life easier. Speaking of e-patients, by the way, this is a shirt from e-patient connections, a conference that I don't know if it still exists anymore. Anyway, we can have some sort of an anything. I'm giving away this shirt tomorrow after I'm finished wearing it. And sorry, I can't launder it. But so if anybody has an idea on how to decide who gets it, either that or I take it home. Anyway, so that's what the IOM said. Dr. Sands says, and this is essential for meaningful use, how can patients participate if they don't have the information? You know, how could you possibly, if you're having a deck added to your house or something, how could you possibly participate if you weren't allowed to look at the drawings and even have a copy, you know, and show them to your cousin and things like that? Now, this is the BMJ again. They are the leader in, so this is embracing patient partnership. Anybody know when this was published? 1999. Woohoo! Once again, we get to say this is not a new idea, all right? But it's still, you know, the dance metaphor is good. You know, I was in college in Boston in the 60s when feminism came through, and it used to be, I mean, I took dancing lessons as a little boy in first grade with white gloves. This was in the early 50s, and I would...
They still have dancing classes here.
With white gloves?
Not with white gloves, but in elementary school.
My, my. There you go. And Patty Lawrence, I wish I could find her, but anyway, she would follow and we would do waltz and box step and everything. Anyway, that ain't the way it was happening in the 60s. And during the change, we would step on each other's toes as we were clumsy about the change. But, you know, move forward. Well, so we go back to this. People perform better when they're informed better, and there's an important corollary because so many people have the experience, so many people who work in medicine have the experience of having a patient come in who is clueless. They don't know what they're talking about. My view on this is it's perverse to keep people in the dark and then call them ignorant. But that's exactly what happens. No. You wouldn't understand. Stay away from that. And then you end up with people who have never looked at it and don't know what they're talking about. You know, so we band together. We get ourselves educated. And today, as many of you know, it is not uncommon for a patient to know something that the doctor hasn't seen yet. And that's no insult to the physician. All right. The only insult to the physician is if they say, if they think, if I haven't seen it, it's not true. Right? So, paternalistic caring. People talk about paternalism, and I'm filling your head with this stuff so that, you know, when you go back to your life and you talk to other people, you have answers to the arguments that come up. People talk about paternalism as if it's always a bad, insulting, arrogant thing. But when my granddaughter was born 2 years ago, I got a new view of this. This is not her, but this, she needs to be taken care of. You know, the essence of good paternalistic caring is, no, honey, no, you don't know. I'll take care of that. I'll decide that for you. Now, here is my granddaughter. Ha! When she was just a few months old, when she goes for a ride in the car, her parents put her in a rear-facing car seat in the back seat and take her where she needs to go because she has no capacity to even understand the issues. All right, but she's almost two now. She's entering the age of no. She's starting to have opinions. And there will come a time where she's asked, do you want to go to the beach today or a movie, et cetera, et cetera? And there will come a time when she does understand the issues and speaks up. And the art of managing culture change here is to have a grip on what is it? What is the condition of the person that is evolving and growing? And so this is really useful. What do we mean by empowered? Now, people have all kinds of definitions. You know, in the 60s, I learned to think of it as a disempowered person who says, well, there's nothing I can do, because that's the expression of being disempowered, powerless. There's nothing I can do about it. And it's not just patients who act disempowered. Physicians looking at federal regulations often have that same thing. I'm just screwed. There's nothing I can do about it. Well, as it turns out, at the World Parkinson Congress a couple of years ago, a patient presented a definition that already existed that I had never heard about, and it's fabulous because you can really sink your teeth into it. And wait till you see where it came from. It's increasing the capacity of individuals or groups to make choices. Somebody who can't make a choice, can't decide something, feels disempowered, and to transform those choices into actions and outcomes. Because if you make a choice, like I want this, but you're not able to act, right? Or you're not able to produce the result. So this is a step-by-step model for what we mean by empowering people, increasing their capacity, like my granddaughter, to make choices, and her capacity to transform those choices into actions and outcomes. Guess who that was from? The World Bank. This is their definition they use when they go into a developing nation, and the community there doesn't know how to do things like this. Now, look at, so what does it take? Remember the thing about it's perverse to keep people in the dark and then call them ignorant? Well, if you prevent people from increasing their capacity to make choices, you're disempowering them. All right, now we've got you can sink your teeth into this definition, right? Well, so it's disempowering to keep people in the dark, and it's perverse to then call them impotent. You know, so this is like, give me my data. In fact, just to quickly wrap this up, the World Bank goes on to say, an empowering approach to participation treats poor people as co-producers, sounds participatory to me, with authority and control over decisions and resources devolved to the lowest appropriate level. There's the understanding. What are they capable of? And if you change poor people to patients, look what you've got. Treats patients as co-producers with authority and control over decisions and resources devolved to the lowest appropriate level. I'm doing the happy dance. Is this great or what? And it was a patient, right, who, you know, that Parkinson's patients are stuck with it. They do not escape. All they can do is manage their trajectory, have it be a long, slow glide or a rapid decline. The corollary here again, it's perverse to keep people in the dark and then call them ignorant. Now, some people, one of the things I have in the book is 10 things e-patients say, because a lot of people are thinking, okay, I'd like to be one of these. How do you do it? Here's how I introduce myself to every new doctor. I did it with my dermatologist a couple years ago when I got a skin cancer diagnosis. I'm the kind of patient who likes to understand as much as I can. Can I ask some questions? So there you are, introducing yourself and sort of level setting, and you're bringing up the idea of you asking questions. Now, I have heard of cases where people have asked this, and a doctor has said, I prefer to ask the questions. There you go, fair enough, have a nice life. Find a different doctor, you know? It's not like a divorce that's splitting up a family, for heaven's sake. And here's one thing, as I try to work toward a conclusion here. This is one reason why it's really, 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 really important to get good at this. We need some chairs. Somebody new has arrived. We've got several chairs up here. We can bring them to the back if you want. So I just turned 65 this year, and this is not what I thought 65 was going to feel like, for sure. But it turns out, this was a couple years ago, 2013, half of all the humans who have ever reached age 65 are alive today, which is astounding, astounding throughout all of history. And I'll show you some specifics. For one thing, at the end of World War II, there were 2.3 billion people, and now there are three times as many. Now you consider, I tried to die in my 50s, and medicine saved me. So I'm getting old to have chronic conditions. Woohoo! Here's my college classmate, Jay. By the way, at the end of when Social Security started 80 years ago, median life expectancy for an American male was 63 and a half. I was that age 2 years ago. And if that were still true, half the kids I went to school with would be dead by now. And that's nowhere near. The world has really shifted. My classmate Jay posted on Facebook he's having a pacemaker put in. The reason he's alive to have his pacemaker put in is because twice in the previous 10 years, medicine saved him from dying. So in a sense, amid all the horror of medical errors and disasters and things that are done wrong, that didn't have to go wrong, meanwhile, a whole lot of people who would have died are being saved to live and get older, which puts us all in the position either of further crushing the healthcare system or being given, having the autonomy and being given the tools to manage ourselves at home, right? So this is the point that I make. Well, so I know many of you know about this report that Pew Research published after Susanna Fox left. What they did was they, and there's none of this is analysis, this is census data. Right, and all they did is make a graph out of it. They took the census data and broke it up into five-year bands, which is how it's reported. I'm the kind of guy, I went and got the original data to see where this graph came from. So on the left side is men, on the right side is women. This is 1950 when I was born. See how many people were over 65? No wonder it seems old to me, right? Well, and the dark bar is the baby boomers coming along. Here we are today. The population is obviously much bigger, and look how what proportion of it now is above the line. And on top of that, here's what it is one generation from now in 2050 when I turn 100.
Wow.
All right? And down at the bottom in the fine print, and this is on my blog, epatientdave.com, the blog post titled, I'm 65. That's really old. So you can look it up if you want. Notice, number one, that people just are not dying. The Pew published this as the population pyramid is becoming a rectangle. You know? And down at the bottom is what percent of the population is each bar. One generation from now, 3% of the U.S. population is going to be women 85 and older. One person in 30 in the U.S. is going to be women 85 and older. Half that many is going to be men that same age. I was amazed yesterday. My flight here yesterday, the incoming flight came from Tampa, which is like retirement heaven. 10 wheelchair patients were brought off that flight. The two wheelchair attendants were like, go back, get another one, go back, get another one. It's happening. So, and one thing, by the way, as a grandparent, and my wife is going to be getting both knees replaced this year, so I have a fair amount of experience with wheelchairs these days, and a grandparent. I want to know, why are strollers so tricked out with options and accessories and cup holders, and wheelchairs aren't? I want the wheelchair companies to start doing that, or better yet, just have the strollers companies start a fight and start making granny strollers. Anyway, I used wheelchairs myself when I was. Anyway, I'm gonna close by trying to quickly review things. I've been studying a lot about this meaningful use war, and briefly, for those of you, if there's anybody who's not aware of it, The question is whether the government should lay off on its requirement that doctors and hospitals have to make it easy for us to get a copy of our data. There are two doctors I immensely respect who I'm going to talk about. First of all, Bob Wachter, who Casey works with a lot. This guy is great. I have personally worked with him at some retreats and workshops. He's very patient-centered. And so his new book, which is getting rave reviews, I'm about a quarter of the way through it. And to me, it isn't, I don't even want to discuss health IT policy anymore with anyone who hasn't read this book and understood what's in it. It's titled, subtitled, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. I created my own subtitle for it, How We Got Into This Mess and What to Do Next. And in fact, it's funny because I love just about every word that comes out of this guy's mouth, but here's his blog post about meaningful use in November. Meaningful use, born 2009, died 2014. And his point, that there's a lot about it in the book. So I want to keep moving ahead, but if somebody is opposed to meaningful use, it does not mean they're an anti-patient arrogant jerk. All right. And it turns out that in order for to do what we call meaningful use two, there are 23 categories of thing with 125 different things that you have to check off, and if you miss one of them, you don't get your money. And now what's happening later this year is it's becoming actually a penalty. You get paid less for everything you do. And so people are screaming now. Here is Peter Elias. He's a member of the board of our Society for Participatory Medicine. It's funny, he showed up at a thing in Maine that I spoke at several years ago. And he had never heard of participatory medicine, but it's how he's always been practicing. So here he is. Notice how similar this is to the picture of Dr. Sands and me. Excuse me. The computer in between. Well, his blog, he has numerous blog posts about what it's like to be a doctor in today's system. CPOE is one of the big things medical records do. Computer physician order entry. You go through the computer menus to put in the instructions so that they all get in there in a way computers can analyze. At a recent clinical staff meeting, a physician complained that the way we have to do this in these computers, which are ridiculously hard to use, many say, is slowing us down and causing errors. The IT staff said, oh, come on, it's not a big deal. You guys are smart. You can do this. Well, I for one, have used software and websites that suck. Yeah. And that has nothing to do with whether I'm smart, right? Yeah. Well, but what are we going to do now? Because it's game on. It is, so the, and there's a real problem happening that I'm hearing through the grapevine. If somebody is at, say, 110 of the 125 checkboxes, and they know there is no way they're going to get to the rest, so no matter what they do, they're not going to get their money. Some of them are saying, I give up. I'll just take the hit. I'm getting paid less, and I'm going to stop trying. Now, I think there's an opening for the patient community to say, look, can we figure out something like and urge the government? This is why, as Regina says. So anyway, Peter, being a smart and funny guy, said, I'd like to see them forced to use their own version, computer process for organizing errands. All right, here's how it would work. Every errand they do, go to the computer and start the EMR, the errand management resource. Go to the schedule errands tab. For each errand, pick from a list of 20,000 possible predefined errands. And if what you want to do isn't in there, too bad. You got to pick one that resembles it. Link it to a household. This is what they go through, okay?
Peter Elias is brilliant.
Well, he is. If there was no appropriate category already listed, you'd have to navigate to the Categories tab and pick a new one from the list of 15,000 carrig. Some errands would ask for details. What kind of gas are you going to get? How many bananas? What color of paint? And so on. So this is the fact that some physicians are saying meaningful use stinks does not necessarily mean they're opposed to what we're talking about, which is what we call VDT, view, download, and transmit our data. The futile urge for certainty. This, you know what, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip ahead. This is something really important, and if you want the details on this, email me and I'll send it to you. It's on average, it takes 17 years for half of doctors to start using new knowledge. That means you pick a random condition and pick a physician name out of the phone book. According to this report published again by the Institute of Medicine, odds are that the name you pick out of the hat will be 15 years behind the curve on the latest knowledge. We can't insult physicians about this because there are over 2,000 new papers published every day. Who could possibly keep up? But we can insist that they value our partnership. A great example of this is Janet Freeman Daly, one of the newer members of our society, who in an amazing twist lived on my floor of the dorm a few years after me. She was dying of lung cancer. She's a non-smoker. She says the only thing she ever smoked was a salmon. And but she joined a patient community on Inspire.com and learned about a new clinical trial and brought it to her doctors at Virginia Mason Medical Center. They said, excellent, and she is NED now, no evidence of disease. If they had said, I want to be the one to do the thinking here. So, and this, it turns out this is part of a bigger trend throughout history. See, this is when you know you found a force of nature. And this is the kind of thing where just piling on more facts is not going to change it. We need to be more effective as change agents. Scurvy. They figured out how to cure scurvy in the early 1500s. This chart is the year of a discovery, and this is how long it took for word to spread everywhere. Now, scurvy kills sailors on ships in an era where you can't just helicopter in a replacement, right? And yet, it took 264 years for that word to spread through the British Empire. We think, I certainly thought, that when my case happened, I was going to, that everybody would drop everything and find the latest treatments. Now, I happen to be at a great hospital for my disease. Other examples are childbirth fever, and even in the 1970s, H. pylori, the doctor who said, you know what, I think stomach ulcers are caused by a bacteria, was ridiculed. And it took 20 years. He finally ended up drinking a cocktail of the bacteria in front of a medical audience and gave himself an ulcer, and then they believed him. He got a Nobel Prize for it, and I gave a talk in Stockholm last year. I got to visit the Nobel Museum, and there is that little beaker strung up on a wire that he drank from, and a Frankenstein comic book page behind it in the Nobel Museum with people with pitchforks and torches coming after this doctor for the heresy of his idea. And this is this a scary thing. This is the half-life of facts. Things become untrue that were true. And who else? Peter Elias on Facebook last week said, you know you're old when what you were taught in school is proven wrong, and you know you're really old when it's proven right again. my cancer was discovered during a routine annual physical. Well, guess what? You're not required to get annual physicals anymore. It turns out that doesn't matter. Our urge, and Casey popped up and said, yeah, that was Sandra who said that. Information alone doesn't change things, and I'll skip through this. This is from that same Institute of Medicine report. This is what they said about how well medicine uses new knowledge, okay? They said science does its stuff, and a whole bunch of it just spills, never moves forward. Some of it becomes evidence, and a whole bunch of the evidence gets ignored. Ha, ha. Ah. Some of the evidence, therefore, reaches the point of care, but the experience of care doesn't get captured poorly, so it doesn't get fed back in to improve things. And this is not the hippie patients. This is the Institute of Medicine saying this. And in fact, I think the way to do it is, since some of the science got spilled, this is a smaller thing for evidence, and some of that got spilled, so a smaller part of it reaches care. And let's see, I'm going to skip over 3D printing, but it's marvelous. For those of you who don't know, it is now possible to get a cheap 3D printed copy of yourself done. And I have in my suitcase back there, I have my mini-me's, because of course I got it done to me. And in fact, I have my CAT scan data in my computer, and I sent it to the guy in Holland who produced my TED talk, and they 3D printed my bronchi with the tumors attached. And of course, the skeptics say, well, what are you going to do with that? I say, I don't know, it's my data, you know? Well, and that... I mean, who wants to know, you know? Maybe I'm easily excited. I don't know. I just, Casey, why is it that just having you in the room makes me say things like that? I don't know.
Warren Zevon wrote a song.
Excitable boy. It's been mentioned. Anyway, the other doctor is Eric Topol, one of the world's leading cardiologists. He's predicting the end of the stethoscope for cardiology, which is astounding, because the stethoscope, you listen to sounds to build a mental picture, if you're smart enough, of what the valves must be doing. And now he has a handheld ultrasound called the V-scan. Put the wand on the patient's chest, or you could put it on your kid's chest, and you see on the display what's happening. It's now possible to have a deaf cardiologist. How's that for amazing, right? So he has this book now, which is about a completely different dimension of the change. He says the patient will see you now. This is not the first book of this title, by the way. Did you know that you can't copyright the title of a book? You could publish another book titled Gone with the Wind if you wanted to. It'd probably be stupid, but you can't. Anyway, patient will see you now, and what he's pointing to is that while the medical record systems are strangling and suffocating with chains on their ankles and everything, we are generating clouds of data. Yeah. Garmin wristband, Fitbit, I have the heart rate monitor here, we have a Wi-Fi bathroom scale. One example, I'm sure lots of you know what this is. This is an iPhone case called the Alive Core. Those are silver electrodes. You put your fingers on them, you flip it over, and it gives you an EKG. And it is FDA approved. It's not a toy. So now all of a sudden, see, 200 years ago, if your baby had a fever, all you could say is the baby's really hot. Now you have a thermometer and you can say 102.4, all right? That didn't put pediatricians out of business, right? It just makes you more informed. Similarly here, Hugo Campos, our buddy, he has an implanted defibrillator in his chest. And his doctor gets these printouts of what happened to Hugo's heart every day. Hugo gets to see printouts not on his iPad every 6 months or so when he goes to visit. That's disempowering. Well, so what happened? And he asked the device maker, Medtronic, I want to see the continuous data coming out of this thing so I can see if I'm doing something that's making my heart go crazy. And they said, no, you're not our customer. And I'm sure the lawyers got involved also saying, yeah, if he discovers we have software bugs, could be not so good. So anyway, Hugo's like, heck with you guys, and he got an Alive Core now. And it's important, a couple months after he got the Alive Core, this is the profound shift that's happening. After he got the Alive Core, he woke up at 6 in the morning with a strong arrhythmia in his heart. And he thought, I think this is atrial fibrillation, AFib. That's just like palpitation, no big deal. But he grabbed the Alive Core, put it on his bare chest, and it said, no, you are having ventricular tachycardia, VTAC, which he knows will kill him if it doesn't stop fast. So how's that for useful information? As it happens, it did. By coincidence, the next day, it was a regularly scheduled download of his Medtronic information, and son of a gun, non-sustained VTAC episode. The iPhone case data was as good as the data from the thing wired into his heart. All right? And importantly, importantly, he doesn't have to ask permission to get the data. He's the kind of guy, he wants to analyze it himself without the FDA involved. He downloads the data and he does his own stuff in spreadsheets, in Excel, looking for things. And he's found useful patterns, okay? Anybody here, I know some of you have heard of the DIYPS. This is way, 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 way out at the leading edge of this. Right, when one of my cheesy marketing slogans is, when assets digitize, things change fast. Well, people with diabetes now, some have a CGM, a continuous glucose monitor, and a digital pump. And what happens is the devices collect numbers about your glucose level and your carbs on board and all kinds of things. And then software says, so poke this number into the pump. Well, Dana Lewis, who's the woman who invented tweet chats years ago when Twitter was new, she has diabetes, and there is a movement in the diabetes community. You can look at the hashtag, we are not waiting. They are fed up with waiting for the industry to get them better products. I didn't realize this until I did a gig with Carrie Sparling, the famous Six Until Me diabetes blogger. It is not rare for a person with diabetes to die in their sleep, even if their life is basically going okay. And this makes it hard to fall asleep, you know, to get a good night's sleep. And one person kept a diary for one day of every time she had to measure something, think about something, be aware of something, do something differently, enter some instruction 300 times, and it's every day. You don't get to say, I'm taking a week off every day, because you can die if you go out of control. Say you die in your sleep, because even if your device sets off an alarm, if your brain has already crashed from low blood sugar, you might not wake up. So Carrie talked about how when she travels, she puts her, and she's alone in a hotel room, she puts her device in a water glass at the bedside. So if it starts buzzing, it makes a racket and it wakes her up. But there are some people who crash hard, and so she says some of them get an earthquake app. And you put the pump on the CGM on top of that, and if it starts shaking, the earthquake app sets off something that wakes up the whole hotel. So they're like, I do not want to wait. We are not waiting. So they started this Night Scout project where the devices upload their data to the cloud so that they can do the sort of stuff that Hugo's doing. And Dana and her boyfriend, now fiancé, Scott, hacked into these FDA-approved devices and got the data. He's an iPhone programmer. He wrote a different piece of software to try to maybe make better predictions for what she should tell the pump, and look what happened. They blogged all of this. Over the course of a year, the predictions are much closer to reality now, and she's now, her glucose level is more stable than a person who has a working pancreas. And so in December, they said, instead of looking at the iPhone, why don't we try plugging these directly? What they said, close the loop overnight. And indeed, it works. And so now, with the patients having control of the data, they have donated it to open source, an open automated pancreas system. And if I were in that, I mean, I presented this. One of the signs of change is that the Mayo Clinic invited me to be visiting professor this year. And when I presented this to the residents, you know, newly trained doctors, you should have seen the look of horror. How on earth am I going to manage a patient like this? Brave new world kids.
And manage is not the best word then.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and yet they're trained that it's their responsibility to, right? And this is, it's the good thing is to get them early instead of when they've been through 20 years of, anyway, Medtronic Diabetes bragged, excited to be partnering with IBM's new Watson Health Unit to explore ways to optimize patient outcomes. Yeah, good, thanks Medtronic. What's your view on patients getting their data? And Dana came back and said, Watson gets access to my data. I still can't get it on my FDA approved device. Well, but this is so, and that's this is why. And just one final thing, there is a dimension of patient engagement where I have a success to report. And this is the part where we go around, I go around saying, please listen to us. And they say, you know, you got to do your part in managing your health. And this is another area where information alone has never helped me. So I have a Wi-Fi bathroom scale, and that is how much good it did me in reducing my weight. Yes. And which is like not much, right? But last November, I got told that I am pre-diabetic. Now, my hemoglobin A1C is one notch over the line, and that made me start thinking a lot about the life of Carrie and Dana and so on. So I went out and got myself fitness wristband and heart band, and here's what happened over the holidays. Oop, weight went up. Information alone doesn't change things. Then I got wind that my YMCA, see, behavior change is hard, right? I got wind that my YMCA has an evidence-based diabetes prevention program. So I got into that, and I started using MyFitnessPal to track how much my fat intake was, which is part of this program. Strong support from my wife, Ginny. It's funny, she wouldn't go to the classes, but she'd grab my homework and do things. Anyway, here's what happened, right? Over the course of 3 months, it's approaching 5 months now. I've lost 30 pounds, which is amazing when you think about that. 1 gallon of water weighs 8 pounds. So that's like, I lose another 2 pounds. That's the same as if I'm no longer carrying around 4 gallons of water. It's easier to get up out of a chair and so on, and I just love buying skinnier clothes. Yeah. So anyway, and this makes me realize, OMG, our needs are different from theirs, from the doctors. Do we argue about what they do with their computers, or do we say, maybe we need two sets of books? And I know tools like Lifetime Health Diary are exactly the sort of thing, you know, and CareSync that Amy Gleason did for exactly the reason she couldn't get them to do it. I looked at this accounting thing. It's very interesting. This is about the accounting issue. It's entirely reasonable there be considerable differences between the two practices. After all, corporate accounting standards are set by independent financial accounting standards, while the IRS code is a product of the political process. Does this sound a little bit like the medical record system? So here's what it all boils down to. I say, let my data go with blue buttons off into the distance.